Chapter 18. Patton Thimble. Going Rockside. Geared Bure's Translithopede. Glossy is not so hard to understand. It uses subliminal symbols and head words. Don't look for a mystery in it. It isn't there. That's why it works so well as a private code. There is no encryption, at least no mathematical encryption, to be calculated and broken. It is idiomatic and visceral. It is verbal impressionism. It uses the uncalculable, unregulated mechanisms of poetry and intimacy to perform its functions. There have been times in the last, well, the increasing years of my career, let's say, there have been times when an ally or retainer of mine has sent me a glossier message using terms and words that have never been used before, and still I have understood them. It's a knack. It's knowing how to use and improvise a shared cant. There are basic rules of construction and metaphor, of course, but glossier's strength lies in its nebulous vagueness, its idioms, its resonance. It is akin to the gut slang of the Erminos, who have replaced language with subtleties of skin colour. Patton Thimble, for example. Patton indicates a course of action or behaviour. Thimble is a qualifier, disclosing the manner or mode of said action. A thimble is a small tin cap that you might use to protect your finger from the short, sharp stabs of a needle during darning. It wouldn't fend off, say, an atomic strike or a horde of gene-stealers. But in the idiom of glossier, it would seal you up against sudden, spearing close attacks. It is also quiet and unremarkable. And so, quietly, unremarkably, I slipped down the tunnelways of Kinchair Minehead towards the officium of the administratum. I was stealthy and secretive, and my motion tracker and shotgun were my thimble. Patton Thimble. Gideon Ravener had coined that particular phrase, adding it to the vocabulary of my glossier. I thought of Ravener, alone in his plastic-sheeted cot on Thracian. My anger, dimmed these last few months, welled. My motion tracker warned me into cover at a junction of transit tunnels, about half a kilometre from the plaza. Hidden behind a stack of empty promethium drums, I watched as two electric buggies buzzed past, heading towards the concourse area. Bandleby was driving the lead one. There were two miners with him, and three more in the buggy behind. They all looked grimy and slovenly. There were more buggies in the plaza, parked out in front of the security office. I saw a couple of labourer types lounging in the building doorway, smoking low sticks. I slipped into the miners' welfare through the back. Medea and Amos were waiting for me in the shabby rec room billet. Well?
We nosed around the administratum, said Amos. It wasn't even locked.
Then the place started to crawl with Khalil's people, and we skedaddled, said Medea. Both of them looked tense and pensive.
They see you? She shook her head.
But there is a damn sight more than 20 of them. I counted 30, 35 at least.
What did you find?
Recent archives are non-existent, or they've been erased, said Amos. Nothing for the last 2.5 months, not even a caretaking log. The sort of thing you'd expect Khalil to have been obliged to keep.
He could be recording it at the security office.
If he was following official protocol, it would have been automatically copied to the central archives. You know how anal the administratum is about keeping full records.
What else?
Well, it was a cursory examination. We didn't have much time. But Khalil told us Imperial Allied pulled out 9 months ago and Ortok Promethium followed them 2 months later. According to the archive, both corporations were active, working, and fully crewed as recently as 3 months ago. There's no record of any grave cases, nor any filed reports or memos about the possibility of such a problem.
Khalil was lying.
In all respects.
So where is everyone? Amos shrugged.
Do we leave now? Medea asked.
I'm determined to find Bure, I replied. And there's something afoot here that really ought to...
Gregor... Amos murmured. I hate to be the one to point this out, but this isn't your concern. Although I know full well you are as loyal to the Golden Throne now as you ever were, in most respects that matter, you're no longer an Inquisitor. Your authority is no longer recognized by the Imperium. You're a rogue. A rogue with more than enough problems of your own to sort out without involving yourself in this.
I think he expected me to be angry. I wasn't. You're right. But I can't just stop being a servant of the Emperor, not just like that. No matter what the rest of mankind believes me to be. If I can do any good here, I will. I don't care about recognition or official sanction.
I told you he'd say that,
Medea sneered at Amos.
Yes, you did. She did,
he said, looking back at me. Sorry to be so predictable.
Moral constancy is nothing to apologize for, said Amos.
I took the scroll of paper I'd recovered from the annex and showed it to my old savant. What do you make of this? I told them what had happened in the sanctum of the machine god. He studied the curling sheaf for a few minutes, checking back and forth.
There are elements of this machine code that I can't make out. Adeptus encryption. But, well, look at the text breaks. These are the filed records of regular transmissions from outside the minehead, every 6 hours to the second.
And the sanctum's dormant systems would wake up the moment an external transmission came in?
In order to record it, yes. How long were the machines in life?
I shook my head. 2, maybe 2.5 minutes.
2 minutes, 48 seconds?
He asked. Could be. He ran his finger along a line of header text above the last code burst.
That's exactly how long the latest transmission lasted.
So someone's out there, outside the minehead on Kinchair somewhere, sending regular transmissions back to the Adeptus Annex.
Not just someone. It's Bure. This is the Adeptus code form for his name.
Amos leafed back through the sheets and studied the yellowest and oldest.
He's been broadcasting for 11 weeks.
What is he saying?
I've no idea. The main text is too deeply codified. Mechanilingua A or C, or possibly some modern revision of one of the hexadecimal servitorware scripts. Possibly Impulse Analog version 9. I can't...
You can't read it. That's enough for me.
All right. But I know where he is.
I paused. You do? Amos smiled and adjusted his heavy augmetic eyewear.
Well, no. I don't actually know where he is. But I can find him.
How? He pointed to a vertical strip of coloured bars that ran down the side of each transmission burst.
Each broadcast is routinely accompanied by a spectrographic report on the location of the transmitter. These colours are a condensed expression of the type, mix, and density of the rock surrounding him. It's like a fingerprint. If I had a good quality strata map of Kinchair and a Geologicae Auspex, I could track him down.
I smiled. I knew there was a reason I kept you around.
So we're going after him?
Asked Medea. Yes, we are. We'll need transport. A prospecting pod, maybe. Can you handle one of those?
Piece of cake.
Where do we get one?
Imperial Allied has an excursion terminal full of them, Amos said. I saw a schematic guide of the minehead screwed to a wall.
I had seen just the same sort of thing, but I didn't recall a detail like that. It reminded me of the extraordinary photo memory Amos possessed.
What about the chart and Auspex you said you'll need? Medea asked.
Any prospector machine will have an onboard Mineralogicae or Geologicae scanner, said Amos. That will suffice. A comprehensive chart, though. That'll be less of a certainty. We'd better make sure we have one before we set off.
He sat down on his cot and began to adjust the settings of his wrist-mounted data slate. What are you doing? I asked, sitting down next to him.
Downloading a chart from the security office's cogitorum.
Can you do that?
Medea asked.
It's simple enough. Despite the graphitics, my slate's Vox link has enough range to communicate with the office's codifier. I can make a text bridge and ask it to send its chart files.
Yeah, but can you do that without knowing the system's user code?
Medea asked.
No, said Amos. But fortunately, I do know it.
How come?
It was on a note taped to the edge of the central control desk. Didn't you see it?
Both Medea and I shook our heads and smiled. Just sitting there with Khalil, talking and sipping fifth-rate Amasek, Amos had soaked up and memorized every detail of the place.
One question, Medea said. We don't know what's going on here, but it's probably a safe bet your friend is no friend of Khalil and his pals. If we can find him using this, why haven't they?
I doubt even an experienced miner could make much sense of this spectroscopy expression. It's an Adeptus code,
Amos said, proudly. It's simpler than that, I said. They haven't found it. The annex was covered in dust, undisturbed. I don't think Khalil or any of his people have been into the annex. Fear of the Adeptus Mechanicus is a strong disincentive. They don't know what we know. In the night, they came to kill us. Once Amos had downloaded the chart and several other files of data besides, we resolved to get a few hours' sleep before making our move. I had been asleep for about an hour when I woke in the dark to find Medea's fingers stroking my cheek. As soon as I stirred, she pinched my lips shut, tight.
"Spectres, invasive, spiral vine," she whispered.
My eyes became accustomed to the half-light. Amos was snoring. I rose off my cot and heard what Medea had heard, the stairs outside the rec room creaking. Medea was pulling on her flight suit, but keeping her needle pistol aimed at the door. I pulled my las pistol from its holster on the floor and then leant over to Amos, putting my hand over his mouth. His eyes flicked open.
"Keep snoring, but get ready to move," I whispered into his ear.
Amos struggled up, snorting out fake snores as he collected up his robe and cane. I had stripped down to my vest. My jacket and motion tracker were on the floor at the foot of the cot. There was no time to reach for them. Someone kicked the door in. The bright blue lances of two laser sights stabbed into the rec room, and a tight burst of stubber fire blew holes in my vacated cot and puffed padding fibers up from the wounds in the mattress. Medea and I returned fire, bracketing the doorway with about a dozen shots between us. Two dark shapes toppled backwards. Someone screamed in pain. A flurry of gunfire from ground level outside slammed up in through the windows, blowing one of them right out of its mounting in a shower of glassite. Ruined slat blinds rippled and jiggled with the impacts. "Back!" I cried, firing twice at a shape in the doorway. A triple pulse of answering lasfire scorched past my head. But light flooded in behind us as a rear door crashed open. Medea swung around, lithe and long-limbed, and broke in the face of the first intruder with a high kick that sent him reeling back. Figures charged in from the doors before and behind us. I shot two, but then was carried over onto my back by two more who struggled frantically to rip the las pistol out of my hand. I kneed one in the groin and shot him through the neck as he coiled away. The other one had his hands on my throat. I speared my mind right into his and triggered a massive cerebral hemorrhage that burst his eyeballs and sent him slack. The smell of blood and cordite and the miners' unwashed bodies was intense. Medea danced back and delivered a forearm slam to the face of another assassin that made him stumble and gasp. She flexed and delivered a spin kick, which hit him so hard he smashed back out of the window. Another was coming at her from behind. I saw a knife blade flash in the gloom. Amos, slow but steady, swung round and broke the knife man's neck with a single punch. Another thing too easy to underestimate about my old savant was the inhuman strength his augmetic exo-chassis provided. There was a little more wild gunfire, and then the spitting sound of Medea's Glavian pistol. I curved my back and sprang back onto my feet, in time to gun down a man with a shotgun who was coming in through the door. Silence. Drifting smoke. Voices were shouting below on the plaza. "Grab your things," I ordered. "We're going, right now." Half-dressed and lugging the rest of our kit, we scrambled down the back stairs. The body of one miner, shot by Medea, lay crumpled on the steps under the first landing. The front of his Ortog Promethium overalls was soaked with blood. There was a livid birthmark on the side of his awkwardly twisted neck.
"Look familiar?" asked Amos.
It did.
"Didn't that creep Bandleby have a birthmark too?"
Medea asked. "Most certainly," I replied. We broke our way through a series of cluttered storerooms and came out in an access alley behind the shops adjoining the welfare. A ginger-haired miner posted as rearguard for the ambush turned in surprise as we emerged, his hands fumbling with a shotgun slung over his shoulder on a leather strap.
"Drop it and come here," I said, using my will.
He tossed the weapon down and trotted over to us, his eyes glazed and confused.
"Show me your neck," I willed again.
He brushed up his tousled hair with one hand and tugged his worksuit's neckline down with the other. The birthmark was there, centered on his nape.
"We haven't got time for this," Amos said.
Running footsteps were pounding through the building behind us, and we could hear shouts and curses.
"Where did you get this mark?" I willed at the ginger-haired man.
"Khalil gave it me," he said slackly.
"What does it mean?"
Driven by my undeniable will force, he tried to say something that the rest of his mind and soul simply forbade. It sounded like Lith, but it was impossible to say for sure, as the effort killed him.
"Damn it, Gregor, we have to go," Amos roared.
As if to prove his point, two miners burst out of the doorway we had come through, aiming auto-rifles. Medea and I whipped around as one and dropped them both, one kill shot each. Amos's faultless recall led us through the winding substreets of Kincher Minehead to the massive, dank bulk of Imperial Allied. There was a hue and cry behind us, mixed with the whine of electric buggies. We ran across the plant's wide metal drawbridge, through a rock-creek gatehouse festooned with razor wire, and on down through the echoing entrance hall. Footsteps followed. The excursion terminal was a semicircular barn of corrugated steel, overlooking the mouth of the main working. Six prospecting pods sat in oily iron cradles under the barn's roof. They were slug-shaped machines, painted in the silver and khaki colors of Imperial Allied. Each one had a rack of flood and spotlights mounted above the cockpit, and several large servo arms and locator dishes arrayed under the chin. "That one!" Medea yelled, heading for the third in line. She was still trying to fasten her flight suit properly. I carried my jacket and motion tracker. There had been no time to stop and get dressed. "Why this one?" I yelled, following her. "The power hoses are all still attached, and it's showing green across the board on the telltales. Unclamp the hoses." I threw my stuff to Amos, who hurried aboard behind Medea through the small side hatch and ran to where three thick power cables were attached to the multi-socket in the flank of the pod. Just as Medea had noticed, all the indicator lights above the socket were green. I twisted the valves and pulled them free, one by one. The last one was reluctant and needed a moment of brute force. Las shots spanked into the hull casing beside me. I jerked the hose free and then turned, firing back down the length of the barn terminal. The pod's attitude thrusters began to cough and wheeze as Medea brought the craft to life. Solid and las shots peppered around me. I ran to the hatch and climbed in. Medea was at the helm in the cramped cockpit. "Go!" I cried, slamming the hatch shut. "Come on, come on!" Medea cursed at the pod's controls. The over-urged engines whined painfully. "Cradle lock!" Amos spluttered desperately. Realizing her mistake, Medea swore expertly, eased the power down a tad, and threw a greasy yellow lever on the right-hand bulkhead. There was a jarring clank as the locking cuff that held the pod tight in the cradle disengaged. "Sorry," she grinned. Freed, the pod lifted out of its landing cradle, swayed to the right as gunfire hunted for it, and then accelerated away into the lightless mouth of the mine tunnels. The upper workings of the Imperial Allied mines were huge excavations, reinforced with rockcrete and filled with abandoned mining machines. Medea kicked in the pod's lamp array and illuminated our path with hard spot beams of clear white light. At the far end of one reinforced spur, the lamps picked out a sudden, wide gradient where the horizontal incuts of the surface mines began their descent. Running down the steep slope were derelict cable trams of filthy ore hoppers and a funicular railway for transporting work crews to the lower faces. Amos sat behind us in the pod's small cabin, reviewing the charts he had obtained from the security office. "Continue down," was all he said. The steep access bore descended for about a kilometer and a half, occasionally flattening into work shelves with entries to side seams. The view through the front screen seemed to be in black and white, the fierce white light piercing the blackness and revealing only pale grey dust and rock. Medea slowed us as we passed over more fragmented and extensive piles of breakdown, and then, under Amos's instruction, manoeuvred us down into the throat of an almost vertical chimney. This chimney, a pitch in mining terms, was a natural formation, possibly an ancient lava tube. Slowly revolving laterally, we hovered down into it. Flowstone caked the walls like swathes of creamy drapery, and quilled bushes of volcanic glass sprouted from outcrops. The space was small, even for a compact pod like the one we had borrowed. Occasionally, Medea would nudge or clip an outthrust of quills, and the glass fragments would fall silently, glittering into the pit below. About 2 kilometers down, the pitch opened out into a complex series of curving tubes, subcaves, and sumps. It was like moving out of an esophagus into the complex chambers of an intestinal tract. The flowstone started to show more color. Steely blues with milky calcite swirls, mottled reds glinting with oolites. Flinty black druze and other clastic litter covered the smoothed folds of the ancient floor. Medea pointed my attention to the small scanner box mounted below the main petrographic assayer. The little screen was awash with an almost indecipherable graphic of ghosting strata layers and reflecting lithic densities. Three bright yellow cursors showed clearly in the upper quadrant. "They're coming after us," she said. "They seem to know where we are right enough.
How are they tracking us?
Same way we're getting such a clean return on their position.
Are the locators on this crate that powerful?
Medea shook her head.
They're fine for the immediate locality, but they've got nowhere near enough gain to penetrate the rock.
So?
I think all these prospector pods have high-powered beacons, probably built into flight recorders.
They'd need them for routine search and recovery. I'll take a look. I swung out of my seat and moved back down the pod, stooping, and using the overhead handrails to support myself. Amos was still at work. He'd fired up the pod's mineralogic ore specs and was running a complex cross-search for the spectrographic fingerprints that appeared on the Adeptus Mechanicus transmissions. He didn't even have the scrolls open anymore. The complex subtleties of the color bars had long since been committed to memory. Every few minutes, he consulted the main chart and called a course correction to Medea. At the rear of the pod, between racks holding old rebreathers with perishing rubber visor seals, I found a small crawl space into the engine bay. I stuck my head and shoulders inside and shone around with a lamp pack I'd unbuckled from one of the rebreather sets. A simple process of elimination directed me to a fat metal drum clamped to the underside of the gravitic assembly and the housing for the kinesthetic gyroscopes. Adeptus Mechanicus purity seals secured its cover. I slid back out into the cabin, selected a medium plasma cutter from the tool web, and went back in. The hot blue tongue of the cutter sliced the drum's cover off and fused its pulsing innards. Back in the cockpit, I saw we were now travelling down a wide cavern that was barred with oily dripstones and varnished with incandescent blooms of moon milk and angel's hair.
"They look lost already,"
Medea remarked, nodding at the scanner box. She was right. The yellow cursors were moving with nothing like the same confidence. They were milling, trying to reacquire our signal. We travelled for 2 more hours, through small flask chambers gleaming with cave pearls, across vast low seas of chert and lapilli, between massive stalactites that bit tunnels in two like the incisors of prediluvian monsters. Dome pits and sumps sheened with brackish alkaline water, and the smoke snaking from nests of fumaroles betrayed the fact that there was now a rudimentary atmosphere. Methane, sulfur, radon, and pockets of carbon monoxide. Venting cases from Kincher's active heart and the gas products of chemical and gravitochemical reactions built and collected here, far below ground, leaking only slowly up to the airless surface. Hull temperature was increasing. We were now about 15 kilometers down and beginning to feel the effects of the asthenosphere.
"Hey," said Medea suddenly.
She slowed the pod and swung it around, traversing the lights. We were in a gypnate chamber where the chert-covered floor was scalloped by several gores formed by water eons before. Several side spurs led away into tight pinches, or were revealed on the chart to pinch out no further than 20 meters in.
"What do you see?" I asked.
"There."
The spot lamps framed a black shape that I thought for a moment was just a jagged pile of boulders and stalagmite bosses, but Medea roved us in. It was a prospecting pod, similar to ours, but bearing the crest of Ortog Prometheum. It had been crushed and split like an old can, the stanchions of its cabin protruding from the metal hull like ribs.
"Hell,"
Medea murmured.
"Mining's a dangerous job," I said.
"That's recent," Amos said, appearing at our shoulders. "Look at the tephra."
"The what?"
asked Medea.
"It's a generic term for clastic materials. The dust and shale bed the wreck's lying on. Move the lamp round. There, the tephra's yellowish-white gypnate all around, but it's scorched and fused under the wreck.
Mineral smoke from the fumaroles we passed just now vent back down here and cover everything with oxidized dust. I'd wager if it's been there more than a month, the powder would have overlaid the scorching and coated the wreck."
"Pop the hatch," I said.
The subterranean atmosphere seemed scalding hot, and I began to sweat freely the moment I jumped down from the sill. I could hear nothing except my breath rasping inside my rebreather mask. I trudged round to the front of the hovering pod into the cones of its lights, and saw Amos and Medea in the lit cockpit, both hidden behind rebreather masks of their own. I waved once and crunched off over the dusty sill, my boot caps catching the occasional geode which scattered and flashed in the light. There was no mistaking the blast holes in the wreck's hull. Sustained fire from a multi-laser had split the pod wide open. I shone my hand torch in through the rents and saw a blackened cabin space burned out. The three crew members were still in there, at their posts, reduced to grimacing mummies by the acidic air and by the hundreds of glistening white worms that writhed and burrowed as my light hit them. It figured that with its hot, wet, gaseous interior, Kincheir was a far from dead world. More troglobite things scurried and squirmed around my feet. Long-legged metallic beetles and inflated, jelly-like mollusks, all drawn to this unexpected source of rich nutrients. Something moved beside me and slammed into my left hip. I fell hard against the broken hull, cursing that I hadn't been wearing my motion tracker. It came in again, and this time I felt a sharp pain in my left thigh. I kicked out with a mask-muffled curse. It was about the size of a large dog, but longer and lower, moving on lean hind limbs. Its skin was nearly silver, and its eyeless head was just a vast set of jaws filled with hundreds of transparent fangs. All around the moor, long sensory bristles and tendrils twitched and rippled. It lunged again, its thin, stiff tail raised high as a counterbalance. This thing, I guessed, was top of the food chain in Kincheir's lightless cavities. Too big to force its way inside the wreck to get at the corpses, it had been lurking outside, feeding on the carrion worms and mollusks that had congregated on the crash. With a twist of its head, it had a good grip on my left ankle. I could feel the tips of its teeth biting through the heavy leather of my boot. I managed to tug my shotgun from the scabbard on my back and shoot it through the torso at point-blank range. Viscous tissues and filmy flesh scattered in all directions, and the thing flopped over. By the time I had prized its jaws off my boot with my knife, the carrion eaters had begun to swarm over it and feed. We moved off again, down a gower-lined spur, and into a cavern breathtakingly encrusted with glass silk and billions of cave pearls. "There's been fighting down here," I told Amos and Medea, raising my voice to be heard over the recycling cabin air as we pumped the last of the coarse Kincheir gas soup out.
"Who's fighting who?"
I shrugged and sat back to tug one of the predator's broken fangs out of my boot leather.
"Well," said Amos, "you'll be interested to know that the cavern with the wreck in it matched one of the spectroscope traces from the Mechanicus transmissions exactly."
"How long ago?"
"About 2 weeks."
"So, Bure could have been the one who did the shooting."
"Bure, or whoever's sending transmissions back to the Annex."
"But why would he take out a prospector pod?" I wondered aloud.
"Rather depends on what the prospector pod was trying to do to him," said Medea.
Amos raised his tufty eyebrows.
"Most perturbatory."
Another 3 hours, another 2 kilometers down. It was damn hot, and the air outside was thick with venting steams and gases. Fumaroles, some large, some in scabby clusters, belched black smoke into the caves, riddling some areas like honeycomb. Several caverns and dome pits were home to luminous acidic lakes, where the geothermals steadily simmered the water. Gorges and the occasional pitch showed flares of red light from lava rivers and asthenospheric cauldrons of molten rock. We no longer had to rely on the lamps. The cave systems were lit by streams of glowing magma, flaming lakes of pitch and promethium, and thick, sticky curtains and rafts of bioluminescent fungi that thrived in the heated ducts. The pod's air scrubbers were no longer able to remove the scent of sulfur from the cabin air, and the cooling system was inadequate. We were all sweating, and so were the interior walls of the cabin. Condensation dribbled down the bare metal of the hull's inner skin.
"Dead stop, please," Amos said.
Medea cut the thrusters and let us coast slowly over a seething lake of lava that radiated a glare of almost neon brilliance from beneath its blackened crust. Amos checked the chart against the spectroscope readings that the Mineralogicae Assayer was sending to a small repeater screen in the cabin bay.
"This is it. The source location for the last transmission."
"You're sure?" I asked. He gave me a withering look.
"Of course."
"Swing us around slowly," I told Medea. We craned to look out of the pod's front ports, playing the lamp array up and down to make sense of the stark shadows in the cavern walls. "What are those? Tube tunnels?"
"Auspex says they pinch out in a few hundred meters." "God, Emperor, it looks pretty primordial out there."
Medea wiped a trickle of perspiration out of her eyes. "What's that the lights are catching there?" Amos peered to where I was pointing.
"Amygdules," he said. "Cavities filled with quartzes or other secondary minerals." Okay,
said Medea, unscrewing the stopper of a water flask.
Seeing as how you know everything, what's that? Well, I... most perturbatory.
It was a hole, perfectly circular, 30 meters in diameter, cut into the far rock wall. Edge closer, I said. That's not a natural formation. It's too precise.
What the hell made a hole like that?
Medea murmured, nudging us in.
An industrial mining drill could...
This far down. This far from any mine infrastructure. I cut Amos short. Look at this place. Only sealed units like this pod can function at this depth.
Barely,
Medea commented, ominously. She was keeping a weather eye on the hull integrity readout. Amber runes were twitching on and off.
It's deep, I said. I looked at the display for the forward scanners. Goes off as far as we can read and maintains its shape and size.
But it's cut sheer through igneous rock, through the side of a 40-kilometer-square batholite. That's solid anthracite.
There was a note of confusion in Amos's frail old voice.
I've got tremors, said Medea suddenly. The needles on the rolling seismograph had been scratching away for a good hour or more. Such was the background instability this deep down. But now they were scritching back and forth wildly.
There's a pattern to them, Amos said. That's not tectonic. That's too regular. Mechanical, almost.
I paused for a moment, considering our options. Take us into the shaft, I said. Medea looked at me, as if she was hoping she'd misheard me. Let's go. The cut shaft was so perfectly circular, it was scary. As we sped down, we could see that the inner surface of the tube was fused like flowstone, with radiating patterns of furrows scooped into it.
This was plasma cut, said Amos, and whatever cut it left an impression of its motivators in the rock before it cooled and hardened.
The tube snaked occasionally, whilst maintaining its form. The bends were long and slow, but Medea took them cautiously. The seismograph was still jiggling. I took out a holoquill and wrote a phrase down on the back of a chart pad. Can you convert this into simple machine code? I asked Amos. He looked at it.
Vade elcuum alateratha semptus. You have a good memory.
Can you do it?
Of course. What is that?
Asked Medea.
Some kind of sorcery?
No, I smiled as Amos got to work. It's like glossia, a private language, one that hasn't been used in a long time.
There,
said Amos. Punch it into the voxponder and set it to continuous repeat, I said.
I hope this works,
said Amos.
I hope you're right.
So do I, I said. Instrumentation pinged.
We're approaching the end of the borehole, Medea called. Another kilometer, and then we're out into a huge cavity.
Get that signal going, I urged my elderly savant. We were on it almost before we were ready. A massive tube of machined metal, 30 meters in diameter and 70 long, with a huge plasma cutting screw at the front end and rows of claw-like impellers that cycled down its flanks like the active teeth of a gigantic chainsword. It had cut its way from the tube and was grumbling across the clastic silt of the chamber floor away from us, pumping thick clouds of vaporized rock and steam out behind it.
Emperor, protect me, it's huge, Amos exclaimed. What in the name of the Golden Throne is that?
Gasped Medea. Slow down, I cried, but she was already breaking us back behind the Leviathan.
Oh, crap,
said Medea. Recessed hardpoints along the giant's flank had swiveled and opened, and multi-laser batteries had popped out to target us. I grabbed the vox set's hand mic.
Vade elcuum alateratha semptus,
I yelled into the mic. Vade elcuum alateratha semptus. The weapons, which could have obliterated us in a single salvo, did not fire. They remained trained on us, however. Then heavy shutter doors on the back end of the enormous machine opened slowly, revealing a small, well-lit hangar space. We won't get another invitation, I told Medea. With a worried shrug, she steered us inside. I led the pair of them out of the pod into the arched dock bay. The shutters had locked shut behind us, and pungent sulphurous fog pooled around our feet as it was pulled out of the bay by chugging air processors. The bay was of a grand design, fluted with brass fittings and brushed steel. There was a brand new prospector pod, painted oxide red, in the docking cradle next to the one that had received our singed specimen. Three other cradles, new and black with oil, lay vacant. All the light came from phosphorescent gas filaments in caged glass hoods around the room, and the effect was a flickering, lambent glow. An iron screw stair with padded leather rails led up to a boarding platform above us. "That's a good sign," I said. The bas-relief roundel of the Adeptus Mechanicus was visible above the inner door lock on the platform. We all started as long servitor arms whirred out from compartments in the walls. In a second, six were trained on us, two with Auspex sensors sniffing us, and four with weapon mounts.
"I suggest we don't move," I whispered.
The inner lock clanked and opened. A hooded figure in long orange robes seemed to hover out onto the platform. It grasped the handrail with both hands and looked down at us.
"Vadis baritis, valsara essem," it growled.
"Vada elcuum alitaratha semptus," I replied. "Valsarum essoque quonda tasabe." The figure pulled back its hood, revealing a mechanical skull finished in oil-smudged chrome. Its lens-like eyes glowed bright green. Fat black cables under its jaw pulsed, and the voxcaster screwed into its throat spoke.
"Gregor. Uber. It's been a long time."